This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
You're listening to the New Evangelicals Podcast. Welcome to the New Evangelicals Talks. I'm Tim, the host of this segment. Join us every Monday as we talk to all different kinds of people at the intersection of theology, politics, and culture, helping you navigate a better path forward in your faith. Hey friends, how are we doing? Good to be here with you. Yeah, I interviewed the one and only Sharon Says So, Sharon McMahon on Instagram. I am also a governor nerd, and we had a great discussion talking about faith, deconstruction, purity culture, politics, social media. This was a phenomenal conversation. Sharon is a total joy to talk to. We also talk about her new book. So this is going to be a phenomenal conversation for you audience out there. And it was so great to have Sharon on. So Sharon, if you're listening to this, thank you again for making time. It absolutely means the world. Friends, thank you so much for being here. If our work is helpful, feel free to share this episode, like and subscribe to the YouTube channel, or if you're listening to this on podcasts, give it a rating and a review. It's just a great honor and privilege to be able to do this work and have you along for the ride. I hope you enjoyed this conversation with Sharon. I will talk to you all later on. See ya. All right. Wow. Sharon McMahon, it is great to have you on the podcast. Finally, talked for quite a few years behind the scenes, and it's great to have you on. Thank you for making time.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thanks for inviting me.
Absolutely. Well, you run the oh-so-famous account, Sharon Says So. I am also a governor. Okay, I'm putting it out there. I've been a governor for quite some time, so it is really a full circle moment to have you on. I want to kind of start right away into kind of your background. I mean, you know, we obviously, you're on a podcast that talks a lot about the Christian tradition, theology, politics, culture, how those things intersect. What is your background? Did you grow up in a faith-based environment? And then we'll get eventually into what got you into loving government and history and politics.
I have always been interested in people's faith. Like, that has always interested me and still interests me. I was the child who, you know, grew up one block away from the library, and I would go to the library and check out all the books about, like, what different religious celebrations around the world. What does it mean to celebrate Christmas in Italy? What kind of holidays do people of the Shinto faith celebrate? Like, those kinds of things have always interested me, and they've always interested me. So I, number one, have always been interested in other people's faiths, from a curiosity and academic standpoint. So that's the first thing. The second thing was, yes, I did grow up in a family that had a faith tradition. And, you know, that was very formative in my life, like it is for many people. Mm-hmm. And it's been an interesting journey as an adult to explore exactly how that has impacted my worldview, how it impacted my, you know, how I was raised, how it impacted what I grew up believing versus what I believe now, which I know a lot of people in your community, Tim, we've had many conversations about the topic, that something you were raised in is often different than what you arrive at in adulthood.
Yes.
So I know that's something with which you are quite familiar.
Yes, yes. We have all different terms. You know, some people call it deconstruction, some call it renegotiating faith. For you, were there certain moments as you just were kind of growing up that eventually maybe you seem like you're a curious person, right? Mm-hmm. And so was it kind of your curiosity that just made you ask broader questions that helped you maybe expand your worldview, including your faith paradigm as well?
Yeah, I mean, there were questions that I could not reconcile. I'm sure you are quite familiar with this dilemma. right?
Just a little bit.
Right here with this dilemma of like, and for me, it started in adolescence, where I really, really, really started pushing back against some of the things that I was taught to believe. And, you know, my parents at the time were not very happy about it. they were not like, great question. Good idea. Let's look into that more. Yeah. You know, like a lot of times this idea that it's wrong to question is very, very prevalent in people's faith communities. Some mm-hmm. faith communities are actually really tolerant of it. Judaism, for example, super tolerant of questioning. You can be both a Jew and an atheist, and those two things are not diametrically opposed to each other. Questions are part of the faith background. But in other faith traditions, that's not okay. And that can get you kicked out of your faith community if you ask too many questions and the wrong kind of questions. Then you're going to start in with the, again, I know you're familiar with this. I'm going to pray for you. Yeah. there's nothing wrong with praying for people, but do you know what I'm saying? Like there were just questions that I could not reconcile, questions that nobody could answer in a way that satisfied me. Mm-hmm. And then behaviors that I could not come to grips with. Mm-hmm. There were multiple times where adults in my orbit, you know, not my parents, but people my parents knew, my parents' friends, that sort of thing. Adults in my orbit said one thing and did something very different. And some of the things they did were terrible. You know, like they are leading these youth group retreats and like telling everybody about purity and purity culture and, you know, blah, blah, blah. And then simultaneously, they're having multiple affairs. Yep. on their wife. That's just but one example. And I bet a lot of people watching this or listening to this have many more. And there are many in the public square even that are, you know, publicly known where leaders have failed their communities. And that has sort of caused a lot of issues where people are not able to both say and do the same thing.
Yeah, I mean, you're 100% on the money, as you know, that I'm very familiar with everything that you just said. So is the audience. So for you, does faith still play a pretty important role in your life now as an adult doing the work that you do?
It does. But it's not something that I really talk about very much because mm-hmm. I am a very, very, very big believer in the importance of pluralism in American society.
Yes.
Pluralism is what America was built on. It is what America should continue to embrace. We should welcome people of other faith backgrounds from our own. And I am not in any way a theologian. I'm not interested in trying to tell people about why my beliefs are the correct beliefs. I am not educated enough to speak on topics related to, you know, religion and like how you should believe. You know, there are people who are far better equipped in that field than I am. And I'm also a believer in staying in your lane of expertise.
Yes.
So I'm not going to tell you how to do heart surgery. That's not my expertise, you know, and I'm not going to tell you what to believe. And so to me, it is not at all important to try to influence people to believe what I believe. I care more about influencing people to embrace certain types of behaviors that I think are important across belief systems. Like all of the world's moral and faith traditions can agree on things like caring for your neighbor. All of the world's moral and faith traditions can agree on things like treating other people with respect and dignity, regardless of who they are to you, regardless of how much they agree with you. So I care more about a set of behaviors that I think move us down, you know, move the ball down the field than I do about getting people to agree on a belief system.
Yeah, I think that's really well said. And I've also been learning to stay in my lane, right? Like there are certain things I'm like, you know, I'll just tag Sharon. Here you go. Go watch Sharon's recap on this, you know, or whoever else it might be, because I think that's something I learned growing up in my evangelical culture. I'm not even gonna say it was intentional. It was just one of those things where I met pastors who thought that because they're a pastor, they can speak on anything they want authoritatively. And I just have to take them at face value as experts in anything. And I didn't want to repeat that myself and go online and start saying things that maybe I'm just not qualified to say, especially when, you know, the internet has some amazing people out there who really are legitimate experts in their field, who are great communicators. Why not just share their stuff and tag them and say, here you go, friends. You have a question about this topic? This person's a great resource for it. Yeah, so
it's so accessible now. It's so,
so accessible. It really is. You
know, when I was growing up, maybe it wasn't that accessible. But to speak to your point earlier today, I even was texting my mom about something from my childhood. Do you remember this person? And she was like, oh, yeah, that person X, Y, and Z. And we remembered that that person used to do a lot of marriage counseling. Like that was their job. And I asked my mom this morning, what gave them the authority to do marriage counseling for all of these people? You know what I mean? Why were they the, like, I actually asked the question, what kind of training or expertise did that person actually have in marriage counseling? And I won't go into the whole story, but nevertheless, I know exactly what you're saying, that there are a lot of fake experts, both in faith communities and also on the internet.
Who speak with
authority in their voice, but who actually have nothing important to contribute.
Does that drive you crazy as someone who, you know, you spend a lot of your time online trying to give people factual accounts of, you know, stories that are happening in the news, whether they're political or just current events? Does it drive you just absolutely, you know, over the wall to hear people say things that are either just, you know, not really that true or just a lot of opinion with not a lot of fact and get tons of views and follows?
I think about this two ways, Tim. The first one is when somebody who is following me asks a question that is not at all rooted in any kind of fact. Like, I heard this thing, you know, is this true? Or I think X, Y, and Z. That type of thing does not bother me. Because I've been a teacher for so many years. I have heard all the questions, right? Like, first of all, don't become a teacher or a parent for that matter. If you don't want to answer the same questions over and over, if you don't want to provide foundational education on something, like don't become a teacher. So to me, that does not bother me at all. That is literally like what I've done my entire career. But where it does start to bother me is where people begin to greatly profit off of fear. They profit off of misinformation. They come to positions of power by lying to you. And they know what they're saying is wrong, and they say it anyway because it makes the cash registers ring. Yeah. That bothers me greatly. Not a person who legitimately doesn't know the answer to a question. Even if the rest of the world thinks that's a dumb question, I am more than happy to answer that without judgment, without shame. I will answer your questions about the difference between House of Representatives and the Senate 300 more times, if that's what I need to do, and I will not judge you for it. But I will judge you if you are intentionally lying to people and putting $20 million in the bank doing it. That is where I have big problems.
Yeah, that makes complete sense. So tell me, I mean, how did you get into falling in love with the government and history and all the nerd things that you talk about all the time? And were you just always someone who was drawn to this kind of work, or did you get into it later on in life? What's the story there?
It started really when I was a child. Yes, I was the kid who grew up one block from the library, and that makes you like peak nerd, right? Literally,
you're like Matilda
from the library. Yes. And then I also, when I was 12, got a paper route. And this is a kind of paper route where you know, get up at the crack of dawn and you walk around with your paper bag and you put it in the door. Well, this was also pre-cell phone, and there's nothing else to do but read the paper while you walk 3 miles a day in the 5 o'clock a.m. in the early morning. What else am I going to do?
What else?
So I would read the newspaper, and I would, you know, carefully refold it before putting it in the door of the subscriber. So I became interested in what was happening in the world. You know, I've always been a curious person, but I specifically became interested in like the news and current events and government from my early experiences with being a newspaper delivery gal. And then I started, I saved my money when I was 15 from my babysitting jobs. I saved my money and I bought a Newsweek subscription. Unbeknownst to my parents, who were not the kind of people who read Newsweek, Okay. They did watch the evening news, you know, sometimes, not even every night, but sometimes we watched it. We turned on Peter Jennings to see what was happening. You know what I mean? But they were not the kind of people who would subscribe to Newsweek. And so when Newsweek started showing up at our house, they were like, what is this? Why are we getting this magazine? And I was like, I bought it. And, you know, fortunately, my parents did not. They were not like, that's weird, cancel this subscription. They were like, hey, if that's what you want to spend your hard-earned money on is a Newsweek subscription, go ahead. But also, you better not start reading 17 magazine. Absolutely not.
Right. Absolutely. We have limits in this household.
Mm-hmm, absolutely not. Those girls in that magazine do things with boys that we do not approve of. Mm-mm. It was fine to read about dictators, but it was not fine to read about to read 17 magazine. I would still buy it and I would hide it in the drawers of my dresser. But I got caught. I still got caught.
Yeah, I mean, that's totally fair. For me, it was playing Nintendo. I was able to play it 1 hour a week and I had a Game Boy, so I would sneak it in bed and play Donkey Kong on my Game Boy Color. So that was my, you know, that's what I was doing at age, I think, you know, 13 or 14. So you've always had a fascination with government, with history. And then what, one day you just say, hey, I'm going to start posting this stuff on Instagram and see what happens. And a million followers later and a book deal and interviewing the vice president of the United States later, you're doing what you do online. Is that kind of the story?
Took one minute. That's all it took. Overnight sensation.
Overnight. Yes.
No, I became a teacher. I became a high school teacher. I taught high school government and law for many, many years. So I legitimately did like learn about these things in college and teaching, et cetera. So I lived in DC for many years. I developed legitimate street cred on these topics. Yes. Right. It wasn't my only credibility was not I read the newspaper at age 12. Okay. I did learn some other things. My account and what I am doing now started as a result of the 2020 election. Yeah. That's how it started. When I started seeing the incredible, like the insane amounts of misinformation floating around the internet, things that were easily verifiably demonstrably false. Yeah. Things like, there is no building that you can go to that houses the Electoral College. Okay. There's no Electoral College building. That's not a thing. That's not real. And so the fact that you are authoritatively coming on the internet saying that that is real, that is demonstrably incorrect, sir. It just is. So I started, rather than getting into arguments with strangers, which I have generally advised against, arguing with strangers on the internet changes very few minds. Yes. I started making little explainer videos and I started explaining how, you know, I started answering people's questions. I would say, what do you want to know? And I would make a very short, nonpartisan, fact-based explainer video. I wouldn't, you know, use the candidates' real names even because I didn't want people to perceive that I was trying to sway who they should vote for in one way or another. So those videos became popular. And I started getting more and more questions and more people were reposting me. And that's really the genesis of how Sharon Says So started.
Wow. And now you have a book coming out, I think in a few months, The Small and the Mighty. Is that correct?
The Mighty. Yes.
Wow. And the pre-orders broke the internet. Congratulations on that.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. I'm excited. It's taken me 3 years of research and writing.
Wow.
So
I am also in the middle of writing a book. And so I have a little bit of empathy and understanding of the work it takes to write a book, although ours are very different. For you, what were some of the challenges? You know, 3 years is a long time. It's a lot of research. What were some of the challenges writing this book? Was it choosing the stories to feature in the book? Was it just the editing process? Give me some of those.
Yeah. I mean, first of all, I wanted to write a book that was not a book of like, here's my ideas, here's what I think about the world. I wanted to write a book for the reader. I wanted the reader to close the last page and just feel like, you know? And so that was part of the challenge, was figuring out which stories to tell and how to tell them in a way that served the reader and not in a way that proved what a great historian I am. You know what I mean? Yeah. Not in a way that's like, wow, that Sharon is so smart. that is not the goal. It is for the book to mean something to the reader. But in order to do that, it took an insane amount of research work, just an insane amount of, like, these are stories of unsung Americans who changed the course of history, whose legacy has been overlooked. And because their legacies have been overlooked, there's not copious amounts of research already done on them.
Right.
And what is out there is very fragmented. There has not been, you know, like a modern storyteller who has come and aggregated all of these little pieces of information about their lives into a story that is compelling and meaningful. And so putting together all of those little pieces of the puzzle has been, in a way that serves the reader, that has been the biggest challenge for me.
Mm. Mm. And when does the book come out?
September of 24.
Wow. Wow.
Yeah. Tell me more about your book. What is your book?
Oh, come on. You're the guest on this podcast. It's not about me.
I know, but I want to know.
The book is a combination of my story and what led to starting the New Evangelicals. And then it's also the second half of the book is more about a better way forward in our faith as Christians. So the working title that I haven't told anyone, but I'm going to tell you, but don't tell anyone else. It's top secret.
I won't.
Is Church, We Have a Problem. Why We Need a New Evangelical Movement. That's the working title. Now, frankly, I wanted the original title to be Holy Shit. I thought it had a great double meaning, but my publisher said, well, it might not be super marketable. I said, well, guys, I'm kind of edgy, you know? So we'll see. Yeah, I got tats.
I have a cardboard beanie and I have tats. Okay.
I'm a drummer. I'm cool. I'm hip, right? You know? So yeah, so that's the book. I just handed in the first draft to my publisher. So we'll start all of the edits and all of the work. But yeah, I mean, it's you know, to writing a book is challenging, and telling part of my own story was interesting, of what, you know, what parts to really pull and what parts maybe weren't worth talking about in the book. Yeah. So that should come out sometime next year, probably in like early 2025. Erdman's is publishing it. So, yeah, a lot of people that I like to interview, like David Gushy, a lot of academics and scholars are on that label. And I was really honored to have Erdman's reach out. So, yeah, so I'm excited for sure. You know, I'm putting myself out there. You're exposing yourself. This is my story. This is what I believe. This is what I think we need to do as Christians. So we'll see how it goes for sure.
My name is Joseph Yu, and I am an Episcopalian priest, and I fully believe in what Project Amplify is trying to do, which is to amplify voices and theology, to offer a counter narrative to the voices and platforms that uses the Bible as a leverage to marginalize, to exclude, and to dehumanize. Project Amplify wants to amplify voices and theology to talk about the love and justice of God, and just how diverse and how inclusive our God is and the gospel is. So if you want to help provide a different narrative of what it means to be a Christian and a follower of Christ, please click the link below to donate. Thank you.
I'm curious for you, you know, you and I have some overlap in that we both deal with the online world a lot. We make a lot of content for online consumption. We get a lot of people in our DMs. What is it like for you being a content creator? As far as like even just managing the stress of always having something to say, always having content kind of out there. And then how's the response? Do you get a lot of haters in your comments or in your DMs? And how does that affect your mental health? I just feel like this is kind of an unspoken thing, because I feel like creators feel guilty talking about maybe, you know, some of the potential mental health challenges they have as a content creator, because we're content creators. It's a cool job, you know, on paper. But it can be challenging, right? There's always this kind of more funnel and feed that you're trying to fill. And we're not robots. We're humans. We have our good days, our bad days, our strong mental health days, our days we need to rest. And the world wants more content. What's that been like for you?
This has been one of the most like challenging aspects of this job, right?
Yeah.
So when you come from a high school classroom, there is, first of all, an opportunity to get to know the people in front of you and develop a relationship with them. And any teacher will tell you that key, crucially important to your success in a classroom is your ability to form a relationship with students. And some teachers are great at it and they are successful teachers, and other teachers struggle and they consequently struggle. So in addition to being able to get to know the kids in front of you, there is a clear hierarchy in a classroom of I'm the adult, I'm in charge. I'm going to get your buy-in, gain your cooperation, that I'm the right person to learn from. But you, as the 16-year-old, are not in charge, right? I'm the adult in charge. You are not. And together, we can have a great time learning things. That is not the case on the interwebs, on Albert's internet, Tim. Yeah. On Beyonce's internet, that is not how it works. And so I'm not saying that I need to be the adult and everybody else needs to be subservient to me. That's not the position at all. But it is a very different dynamic to interact with people who are your peers than it is to interact with people who are your students, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. And then you have to add in the incredible number of trolls that exist, where it's so difficult to tell the difference between a Russian bot and an actual dude who, you know, is out to get you. I have overwhelmingly people are kind, generous, warm, lovely, make the work worth it, support me. And so overwhelmingly, that's my experience. But there's no content creator with an audience of any size who will tell you that everything is going great. And if they do, they're lying.
Yeah.
If they do, they're lying. I have a friend who makes food content. Like she cooks recipes and here's a salad that you can make, blah, blah, blah. The amount of incoming hate she gets because she made a dip. She's like, this is a really delicious dip. I like to eat it with take my lettuce and scoop up the lettuce and eat it almost like a chip, instead of just dumping it on a salad. The amount of hate that she got for saying that lettuce could be used as, like, you could scoop it with lettuce instead of using a chip. It's truly staggering what people will get mad at, right? They were mad that you're like, oh, you're body shaming people who eat chips. Right. You're not eating any real food. You're only thin because all you eat is lettuce, you know, et cetera, et cetera. The number of people who were mad at her for suggesting that you could scoop the dip with lettuce instead of pouring the dressing on the salad is just indicative of the overall climate of what it is like to be a content creator today, that there is absolutely no way to make everybody happy.
Yep.
You know, my friend Kathleen, it's a free recipe on the internet.
Right.
We're trolling. You know what I mean?
Like, use chips. I don't care. Like, just buy some.
Give a crap what you dip in the dip. I don't like the idea that you need to go out of your way to insult me because you don't like the dip. You don't like that I dipped lettuce in the dip. That's just like one tiny, tiny example of what it is like out there. So the toll on creators' mental health, myself included sometimes, is significant. It is significant. The human mind is not meant to deal with this much incoming negativity. Mm. It has never before happened in human history. You can be the president of the United States. You know, if you are Joe Biden, there are a minimum of 60 million Americans who actively dislike you.
Right.
Right? Minimum. Active dislike. And that's true of most modern presidents. You could probably cite that same stat against most modern presidents. Even people with 60 million people who actively dislike them are not reading their own Instagram DMs, right?
Right.
They are not engaging with the haters, which is what content creators are being asked to do. A president has a full staff around them, full staff, all the people, they, you know, create this boundary around the president or whoever the elected official is to protect their mental health, so that they can stay focused on their job at hand. Imagine if any president, Trump, Biden, Obama, whoever, spent all of their time responding to DMs. They would be ignoring their important work. So they are protected from those kinds of one-on-one interactions. It has never in human history been the case that a single individual is expected to deal with hundreds or sometimes thousands of negative comments directed directly at them, and that they are expected to engage with those comments as a job.
Yeah.
That has never, ever, ever been a thing. And I every day become more convinced that the human mind is not equipped to deal with it. And I don't mean people, I don't mean wrestling with challenging ideas. I don't mean some people disagreeing with you. Those are important right. things for intellectual development.
Totally.
I mean like the direct insults, the directed hate towards you. I had somebody recently who tagged me in their post that they put up on Instagram stories that took some of the pictures of me that they found online, of which there are many because I've been in a zillion videos, right? Not hard to find pictures of me online. Took some of the pictures of me online, ran them through some kind of AI generator, and created scenarios in which I was being physically harmed in AI pictures. And I will not even go into what was happening to me in these pictures, but then they posted them in their stories and tagged me so that I would see it and so that other people who follow them would see it. That is not normal. That is not, first of all, a normal human behavior, but that's also not normal for humans to have to engage with that. And this is an ongoing challenge. It really is. I don't have any really great answers for it other than I'm just putting one foot in front of the other.
I have to agree with you on all of this, especially around, is the human mind designed to handle this? I mean, you know, we forget that like Instagram is a little over a decade old. Like the social media phenomena is a very new thing. Technology, as we understand it, is very new in the course of human history. Our brains are not designed to receive fire hose level amounts of information 24/7 and then respond to all of it, right? I mean, I think about you and I deal in content that a lot of times is very much current events in the worlds that we occupy, right? And I'm sure like you do, or like I do, I get DMs daily. Oh, here's a story. Can you cover this? Can you talk about that? Oh, this just happened. What's your thoughts about this? And it's like, whoa. I mean, I literally could spend, in theory, 9 a.m. to 10 p.m. just responding to those stories, let alone the other stories I have to get to and the other content and obligations, right? On top of having people who think you're not doing a good enough job, or you know, you said this wrong, or this little thing you got incorrect, or the average troll who really just wants attention. And so it is a lot when your brain is always being stimulated in the digital world. And then you have to turn your brain back to the real world. I have two kids under four. I have a partner. You know, I'm a busy person outside of this. And so it is a lot on someone's brain to have to go back and forth to all these different modes of being and existing and trying to juggle it all. And then also, you know, making content on top of that and being creative. It can be a lot.
Oh my gosh. And I have heard, you know, I've heard from many creators. I know that you and I are not alone in this.
Yeah.
Many creators who have given me specific examples of like, here is what it's like for me. There have been creators who have committed suicide because of the amount of hate that they've received. There have been multiple big name creators who have literally been driven off their platforms because of the amount of toll that this took on their mental health. So to me, it means that it is extra incumbent on us to be good citizens of the internet. And that there is a big difference. Like if you and I have a relationship, right? Like we're friends. Yep. And if you saw something that I posted and you were like, what about X, Y, and Z? Like you were challenging an idea that I had. That is very, very different. And I would, by the way, be more than happy to entertain that challenge because that's part of a relationship, right?
Totally.
And it gives me something to think about and it gives me something to learn and gives you something to learn. Like that is a very different dynamic than a complete stranger who is telling you that you're fat, stupid, ugly, you know, and they hope you die. That's completely different.
Yes.
It is. It's very, very, very challenging to figure out how to engage with.
Well, I also need to point out that being in this work now for a few years, there definitely is a difference between how men and women and other people, other minorities are treated as creators. I will tell you right now, mm-hmm. Sharon, that I have gotten a lot of DMs over the past couple of years, probably 10 or 20,000 total. I have not had any death threats ever against me. I've had people who don't like me, but I've never been called, you know, super really bad names. I get called annoying or dumb or whatever, but like no threats of violence. And I have friends in this space, women who are creators. And in fact, one of my friends, when I first met her, her name's Savannah. She's a content creator. She was joking. She was like, oh, you know, all those death threats that we both get. And I'm like, yeah, yeah. Wait, no, I don't get death threats. She's like, right. You don't get death threats? So I'm like, no, not at all. She's like, oh, I get them. It's not common, but it's also not super uncommon either. Yeah. And so there also is that level we have to just kind of call out that I would definitely say that I have a pretty, maybe a somewhat more easier time in this space when it comes to the comments I get compared to some of my female friends who are also content creators.
Yeah. And also to speak to your point, people, you know, like I am obviously an able-bodied, conventionally looking white woman. And so I don't even think that I have it as bad as some other people mm-hmm. who are, you know, perhaps if you are Jewish or you're Black or you are part of another minority group, those content creators have it even worse. Yep. I have Jewish friends who receive comments about how they should be put in an oven. And these are not even DMs. These are like just posted in the comments. So, you know, I don't even think that you and I have it as bad as it gets on the internet. And it's still extremely challenging to deal with. 100%. But let me tell you, amongst content creators, I have compared notes with many dozens of people. Mm. There is one group that stands out as the meanest group on the internet.
I'll let you reveal this. Go ahead. The
meanest group on the internet is white Christian women. The meanest group on the internet is white Christian women. And I have told this to other people before, and they, you know, it's dismaying, especially if you lead a faith community. It's dismaying to hear that about your flock, right?
Yes.
And again, I am not saying this to throw shade at white Christian women by any stretch. I am reporting the statistics of what it is like to get incoming hate. More often than not, the meanest messages come from people with Bible verses in their bio. More often than not, the meanest messages come from people who have, you know, a picture on a Sunday in their church or in front of their church, or they have overtly religious content posted in their Instagram. More often than not, the meanest people on the internet are not people of color. Mm-hmm. They are not people who have no faith, overt faith. They are not people who are like, yeah, sometimes I go to the Lutheran church on Easter. That's all, you know, they're people who are, it is people who take the time to put a Bible verse in their bio and to post overtly religious content on the internet. They are the meanest people on Al Gore's internet.
I wish I can tell you that my experience did not find that to be true, but it's a running joke in my head where if I do get a pretty nasty DM, I go, I guarantee this person has some kind of Bible verse in their bio.
Absolutely,
and you know, maybe an American flag somewhere and maybe a cross somewhere. And more times than not, I check and right on the nose, there it is.
I got a comment recently where somebody was insulting my intelligence. They were like, and here we reach the end of Sharon's intelligence. And it was a guy, and it was very easy to tell that he worked at a church. And I was like, gee, Chad, maybe don't make it so easy to see that you work at a church when this is how you speak to women. Maybe you should not do that. Just a thought.
There is, you know, it's always hard to know if like, if my experience is broader of the whole, or if it's just my experience. But more and more, I am convinced that, you know, I'm still on Twitter. I'm in a lot of those spaces. And the language I see often from particularly either white Christian men or white Christian women consistently just seems to be some of the cruelest, whether it's talking about some kind of politician that they don't like, or some other maybe political contributor that they don't like, whatever it is. And the language, it's not just a strong disagreement on terms. I mean, listen, we all have our views.
Right.
We all have our disagreements with people. I get that. It's a different level of just snark and dehumanization and name calling and really bringing them down to like the subhuman level of how that person is evil and must be defeated because we have the truth of God inside. And it just like, it's very frustrating to watch the cruelty by some of these spaces and then watching it celebrated by people in my own faith mm-hmm. tradition. You know, mm-hmm. that's a very hard pill for me to swallow, frankly.
It is. So, it's very, yeah. It can be very discouraging.
Very.
It can be very discouraging.
Yeah.
Especially, you know, in your case where you worked for so many years at your church. You were actively involved in your church. You were such an integral part of your faith community, and to then experience how you were treated, and then to extrapolate that into, you know, like a broader, to like experience that over and over and over and over and over and over all day, every day. It can be very discouraging.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I loved being a volunteer at my church. I loved being all in. I love being one of those people, but it is discouraging to see the broader, you know, kind of tradition I was a part of and kind of the fruit that it's producing now. Mm-hmm. So let's go ahead and kind of move into maybe some more of the American politics, which is kind of actually adjacent to a lot of this conversation anyway, mm-hmm. because, you know, I do track a lot of what's happening when it comes to my faith tradition and politics, et cetera. It does feel like we are living in one of the most polarizing times in American history. However, I am not the historian on this call, Sharon, and I'm kind of curious for you, when you think about kind of where we are now, the state of things between the internet, the media, you know, the presidential nominees in front of us, and how things do feel very polarizing. Is this like another level in American history of just tension and polarization? Or is this kind of the American experiment and kind of how it's always been based on what you know about American history?
Mm. It's both. It is both a unique moment in time because of the internet, because of how the fragmentation of the media, because of how information goes viral today, you know, because of algorithms. So that is part of what makes it unique. Right. Yeah. Is those factors. But the idea that Americans strongly disagree on things is not at all new. I mean, we think that the media is partisan today. I'm sure you've heard that a million times. So the media,
I feel that
the media.
Right.
Listen here, folks. The media has been hyper partisan since before this country was a country. You bought a newspaper based on what you wanted to hear in 1750. And the newspaper that you bought had the political viewpoint that you also agreed with. And then you read the insults where people were calling, you know, leaders like John Adams a hermaphrodite, where they were actively involved in name calling. Now, so that aspect is not new. Do you know that more than once there's been guns fired on the floor of the United States Congress?
Mm.
That people have literally been beaten with like a cane within an inch of their life on the floor of the United States Congress, to the point where it took them 2 years to recover. And then the person who did the beating got reelected. Okay. Wow. Like they refused to kick them out. Congress was like, yeah, we're not going to kick him out. And then they ran for re-election and won. Okay, so these ideas are not entirely new in the United States. Mm. Now, that's not to say that it was okay that person got beaten within an inch of their life on the floor of Congress 150 years ago. It wasn't okay. And it's not okay now. Just because it happened in the past doesn't mean that it's okay for us to continue. Right? Something having happened in the past does not mean it is morally correct, does not mean that we should continue in that behavior. We all can all agree we should no longer enslave people. We should not have been enslaving people from the beginning. Just because it happened in the past doesn't mean that it's okay to do today. So I take issue, first of all, with this idea that the past is somehow better than the present, that we need to make America great again. Explain, sir, when was it great? In your estimation, when was it great? There have been great moments in American history. There have been great people in American history. but collectively as a whole, either we have been actively enslaving people, we have been openly misogynistic against women, we have been openly harmful towards marginalized communities, gay communities, etc. There's never been a time that we can point to in the past and be like, boom, that was the perfect time. 1950s, that was it. We can't do that. That said, aside from the Civil War, this is a very unique moment when it comes to American democracy. And I have concerns, as I know you do too.
Hi, my name is Carrie and I live in Kansas and I'm a monthly supporter of the New Evangelicals. I started supporting the New Evangelicals in 2020 when it became clear that the evangelical world that I had been raised in and was a part of was doing more harm than good. Since that time and since following the New Evangelicals, I've appreciated the variety of experiences and opinions that are shared on the platform. And I share the concern over the future and the trajectory of the evangelical church. I'm glad I'm able to support this platform and the content as we continue to offer a different voice in contrast to what's being told to us by the evangelical church. Thank you.
It is interesting because from my vantage point, I'm looking at a faith tradition that has kind of been, and again, in my opinion, one of the biggest complicit groups in kind of pushing us in this very anti-democratic kind of authoritarian direction that is steeped in a lot of misinformation. I mean, you know, you said that you got your work started in 2020. And I started my work around then as well, but more from the perspective of, hey guys, I'm a Christian. I grew up in this world, committed to Jesus all the way, still committed to Jesus. I'm kind of concerned at like some of the political outpourings of my faith tradition. For me in 2016, you know, watching my own tradition that kind of raised me on this very strict purity culture ethic, be like, hey Tim, thanks for doing that. I know that we told you that, you know, God really cares about what you do in the bedroom until, you know, and you can't do anything until you're married. But can you vote for the guy on the cover of Playboy and the guy grabbing women? Because that's God's chosen candidate. And I'm like, wait, I don't understand. Like, this is not how you taught me a man's supposed to behave. So there are a lot of, for a lot of people in on the who are listening in my audience, we saw this and went, I don't understand like how my faith tradition is kind of the one behind this. And then we saw the election, you know, fraud narrative and just so much, so many things that to your point are like verifiably provable that they're not true. Like we have like court cases and data and all kinds of things proving that the election wasn't stolen. And so it just seems like a lot of what's happening as my faith tradition is kind of responsible for upping the ante of how some Americans live in a reality that I just have a hard time understanding where it's coming from. And that's my most charitable way, because I know that that you like to keep yourself nonpartisan. I don't want to drag you into my perspectives on this stuff. But to me, it just really is hard for me to grasp my mind around.
I feel that. I get it. It is really difficult for people from evangelical faith traditions when they learn about their faith tradition's history, that it was primarily evangelical Christians who were members in and perpetuating the KKK, that it was primarily evangelical Christians who promoted Southern segregation and Jim Crow laws, when it was primarily evangelical Christians who ensured that once the Supreme Court said that separate cannot be equal and that schools needed to integrate, that all, in many places around the South, that the public schools just closed and that they would provide private school vouchers for the white students while the Black students had absolutely no access to education. In Prince Edward County, Virginia, for example, the public schools closed for 5 years. Okay. This idea that like the Supreme Court said, you guys got to integrate. And then white Christians all around the South were like, okay, all right, fine. I guess we'll do it. No, that is not absolutely not the case at all. They formed a massive resistance against this idea that Blacks and whites were equal. They could not have it. They could not have the idea that Blacks and whites were equal. Now, I don't want anybody to take this to mean that I am putting down their what they believe. I absolutely respect your right to believe whatever it is that you feel is, you know, a deeply held conscientious belief. But what I, that does not negate that what everything I just said was true about the KKK, about segregation, right, about Jim Crow, about the many of the wrongs that have been perpetuated, especially against African Americans in the United States, have been perpetuated by evangelical Christians. That is just a fact. And again, facts don't require our approval, Tim. We don't have to approve of a fact for it to be a fact. Right. In fact, we can wish that that wasn't a fact and be like, dang it, I wish that wasn't true. So right now, it has become far less socially acceptable to be overtly racist, right? And it has been far less socially acceptable to be overtly anti-Semitic. That doesn't mean that those things don't happen. But people realize that they receive negative repercussions from being overtly that way. And so they find ways to conceal it. They find ways to be able to be like, what? That's not what I meant. You took it the wrong way. You know, like to use these little dog whistles that their members of their community will know that's who she's talking to, or that's who he is referring, you know, to. But they do it in such a way where they have plausible deniability. But yet the people who are in the in-group know exactly what they mean. And you see this most especially in white Christian nationalism, which has been on a significant upward trajectory in the United States over the last 5 years.
Yeah, well, that brings me to my next question, Sharon. So great lead in. Great job. You know, right now, Christian nationalism or white Christian nationalism, it is a phrase that is being used more and more. Mainstream media sources are picking it up, you know, thanks to the work of Anthea Butler and Jamar Tisby and Andrew Whitehead and Bradley Onishi. I mean, people that I talk to all the time who have really helped me think about what, you know, this all is. Some people say, hey, Christian nationalism is a smear used by the left to just, you know, beat down all Christians for holding their firm convictions and belief in God. And other people, like your Andrew Whiteheads and stuff, say, no, this is actually, you know, a very specific political, cultural, theological framework that helps us make sense out of particular movements in the U.S. For you, how do you think about Christian nationalism, its impact in America? Do you see it as the greatest threat to democracy, as some argue? Do you think it's a little more exaggerated? Give me your thoughts on that.
It is a threat to democracy. There's no question that it is. And white Christian nationalists are open about that. They're open about it. It's not a secret. Yep. It's not my opinion that that's what it is. It is, they are overtly pro-authoritarian regimes. Now, they may say, well, like, no, I'm not pro-authoritarianism, because they think, well, I don't want Hitler. You know what I mean? Like, they think that, well, nobody's Hitler, so it's all good. But they are very open about the fact that there are the right people to vote and the wrong people to vote. And that is a movement towards authoritarianism. That there are good Americans, the right Americans that look right. And then there are the invaders. There are the people who are here to, as part of this like great replacement theory, that are coming, invading the United States to become all the voters and to just vote all the Democrats in. They're trying to replace the whites. They're trying, and people may not say they're trying to replace the whites because that sounds too racist. What they will say are things like they are threatening our way of life. That's what you'll hear. Well, first of all, who's our? Who's our? And which way of life are you referring to? And the answers to those questions tell you everything that you need to know, right? So the idea that like authoritarian leaders are being actively courted and embraced by white Christian nationalists, the second anybody is like, oh, Viktor Orban, so great.
Exactly.
Bye-bye.
Exactly.
We're done.
Exactly.
See what I needed to see.
100%. Yeah. Or when you have a political pundit going over to Russia trying to prove how affordable bread is and how great it is over there, it's like
so clean. It's so clean here in Moscow.
Guys, what are we doing?
That's great. Yeah. I definitely would rather have no trash and no freedoms. Perfect.
I might have some new listeners because you're on the show and some of your audience might be hearing some of this stuff maybe for the first time this explicitly. And some people might be thinking, no, Tim and Sharon, you're kind of exaggerating some of this stuff. But as my audience knows, I go to Turning Point USA's events. I go in person. I listen to what they're saying. I do recaps on it. And you are completely correct. I mean, when I was at America Fest, that's Charlie Kirk. That's 14,000 people show up to this thing. Okay.
I know you sent me pictures from it. I'm like, this is how you're spending your weekend.
This is how I'm spending my weekend. I bear my cross for my audience. Okay. It's a heavy burden, but I go to make sure that when I talk about this stuff, I'm not misrepresenting what I'm actually saying about them. Right. And I will tell you from the stage all over the place, including by Charlie Kirk himself, they literally are advocating for the Great Replacement. They say the Great Replacement is not a conspiracy theory. It is real. It is an intentional move by the deep state to replace the voting population with quote unquote third worlders to change the voting demographic of the country. I mean, this, and if you know your history, which I know you do, Sharon, this is literally things that David Duke and the KKK would say almost word for word, right? And so it's, even though it's an uncomfortable truth to recognize, the language that we're seeing in these spaces, and unfortunately is also claiming to be very Christian, is also steeped in white nationalist and white supremacist talking points. It just is. And again, that just concerns me as a fellow Christian, thinking what has happened to my faith that people think this is like an acceptable way to express our love for neighbor as we claim love for Jesus by advocating for these policies that do so much harm to so many of our neighbors. It's very difficult to watch. But one of the questions I wanted to ask you about is, part of the argument for Christian nationalism is that people say, well, Tim, you don't understand. This is a Christian country. America was founded as a Christian country. The founders were overwhelmingly Christian. We have our rights come from God as in the Declaration of Independence. Again, you're the historian. I love having credible voices on the podcast like yourself. Give me your take on the founding of the country. Were we founded as an explicitly Judeo-Christian nation to maintain a cultural heritage that God would keep blessing the country as a shining city on a hill? Or is it more complicated than
that? Okay, there are two things can be true at the same time. Many of the founders were Christians, and they intentionally did not form a Christian theocracy. They intentionally did not do that. Because guess where they came from? Christian theocracies. Where did they come from that they needed to escape from, Tim? Christian theocracy. So this idea that the leaders should dictate a religion and that the laws of the country should uphold the majority religion is what they were leaving. That is what they were leaving behind. Now, we are completely, for the sake of this conversation, ignoring the colonist relationship with Native groups. We're, you know, like that's a completely separate conversation that we can have another time for the sake of time. But let's just assume that all the colonists came here and they had, you know, great intentions and they, you know, did not harm anyone else. The fact remains that they had the opportunity to form a Christian theocracy and they did not want it. They did not want a Christian theocracy. Now, again, that doesn't mean that nobody had faith and that people didn't talk about their faith openly. That's true. But they purposely avoided that, took steps to avoid it. When people, by the way, this is a piece of misinformation. When people talk about this idea that the founders quoted the Bible more than anything else in their early writings, that is not true when it comes to their discussions of government. That fact is only true when you add in the fact that a huge amount of the writing that was published during the founding era was sermons. The vast majority of writing that was being published during the founding era was sermons. And so the writing of the founding era is overwhelmingly Christian because it was coming from churches. When you go to actually examine the writings of the, you know, writers of the framers of the Constitution, Some of them had deep faith in God, and some of them really did not. Some of them wrote their own versions of the Bible, Tim, like Thomas Jefferson wrote his own version of the Bible. Imagine such a thing, where he actually went in and removed any reference to the deity of Christ because he did not believe in that. You can still go online on Amazon and buy the Jefferson Bible. This is not like a random fun fact. Like, that's an actual thing that you can go purchase today, the Jefferson Bible. That is very antithetical to what many Christians believe today, that you could just excise entire portions of the Bible and be like, that part isn't correct. Right. I'll get my own version. Thank you. Alexander Hamilton, by the way, you'll find this out in my book. Here's a sneak peek. Alexander Hamilton, in his final moment, decides, I should get communion. Somebody needs to come give me communion because I'm going to die. And the bishop of his family's church refuses to give Alexander Hamilton communion because he wasn't a good enough Christian. He didn't go to church enough. He did not uphold the tenets of Christianity. Alexander Hamilton then calls another friend or asks, can you go get this other guy? He's a friend of mine. He'll give me communion. This other guy says, it gives me no pleasure, but I cannot give you communion. And then he goes back to the first guy, the bishop of Trinity Church, where his family, his wife and children attended, and says, you know, please, can you give me communion? And the bishop says to him, I don't approve of your dueling. How can you duel with Aaron Burr? And Alexander Hamilton, in his final moment, convinces the bishop of Trinity Church that he's very sorry for having dueled and that he forgives Aaron Burr. And the bishop, finally relents and gives Alexander Hamilton communion. But that just speaks to this idea that the American founders were religious zealots. They were not. Alexander Hamilton has to ask three times to get communion on his actual deathbed in order to receive communion. I'm ignoring the whole fact that Alexander Hamilton was probably raised Jewish. That's another story for another day.
Oh,
but which
spoiler
is probably,
alert.
Yeah, which is probably why he was not a good enough Christian.
Yeah, right.
But this idea that, like, literally in your final moment, when people should have the most compassion for you,
yeah,
people who knew him well, Bishop Moore knew him well, his buddy who ran the Presbyterian Church knew him well, their assessment of Alexander Hamilton was that he was not a good enough Christian to deserve communion.
Wow. Wow. Yeah, that's really helpful. I appreciate you kind of giving us a few examples of, again, maybe it's a little more complicated than some of the narratives that we hear. Mm-hmm. My last question for you, and again, Sharon, thanks so much for making time out of a very busy life of, changing the world and helping governors everywhere out there understand politics and cultural issues better. We're obviously in the middle of an election cycle. It's coming up in a few months here. It is a very unique kind of situation that we find ourselves in. A lot of things are happening all over the place. How do you encourage your audience to think critically about the voting process, who they're going to vote for, how they engage that well, and what are some of the major issues that for you, you push your audience to really consider when they go to the ballot box?
Mm-hmm. It's a great question, and thank you for asking. And for me, it comes down to principle over party every time. Political parties can and will change.
Yep.
We've seen a dramatic shift in one of the two major political parties in the last 8 years, right?
Definitely.
Political parties can and do change. The Republican Party, when it was founded, was progressive. Abraham Lincoln was progressive. They believed strongly in using the power of the federal government to better the lives of people. That is not a conservative viewpoint. The Democrats, when they were founded, believed strongly in segregation and enslavement. And so all that to say, parties can and will change. Your allegiance should never be to a person or a party, because both of them will let you down. Anybody who says, only I can fix it, is a person that you should immediately turn and run from. I alone can fix it is the coded language of an authoritarian. who wants you to follow them to the ends of the earth, and where they will lead you has never been somewhere prosperous. It has never been somewhere that makes America more good, more free, more just, more peaceful. I alone can fix it is something that we should turn away from. So the principles of democracy are more important than any allegiance to party or any allegiance to person. And a candidate who overtly says, I care about democracy and the principles of democracy, that carries more weight with me than somebody who just has the policies that I like. Policies come and go. There's not one policy that America has ever had that has not changed. Policies will come and go. Who you are as a leader is who you will be in a moment of need. And I want to know that the person that I vote for is somebody who truly and deeply cares about America and truly and deeply cares about upholding the principles of democracy more than I like their temporary tax policy, more than I like their ideas about immigration, more than I like what they have to say about a conflict in another country, more than I like who they put down. A good leader is known for who they lift up, not who they put down. And I care more about the moral character of a leader than I do about their specific policies that may benefit me in the short term. And so I always encourage people to investigate how much does a candidate care about the principles of democracy? Does this person demonstrate the type of character qualities? Have they spent their life building character qualities that in a moment of crisis they can return to? Because what they have formed in secret is who will come to light when push comes to shove. And I want to know that that person has spent their life cultivating character that will come in and represent our country well when it's needed. And you can see, for example, you may disagree with every single policy that George W. Bush had. You may think warmonger. You may think went into Iraq under false pretenses, disagree with his stance on abortion, disagree with his stance on gay rights. Like, you may disagree with every candidate or with every policy George W. Bush had, but on 9/11, the character that he had cultivated became very useful. He was able to lead the country out of a moment of crisis in a way that somebody with poor character but good policies may not have been able to. So I care about character and I care about the principles of democracy more than anything else, because policies will change. And if we have democracy, if we do not have democracy, we have nothing.
Yeah, love that. Sharon, it was truly an honor and a privilege to have you on the show. Thanks for being here. I'm sure we'll talk again soon behind the scenes at some point. And I wish you the best and the most successful book launch in the history of humanity ever.
Thanks, Tim.
You're welcome. We'll talk soon.
We'll talk soon.